Welcome to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari Shrike, the artist and creator behind Not Sorry Art. I'm so excited to talk art and creativity with you, so grab a drink, grab a snack, and let's dive in. Are you looking to gain confidence in your painting practice and improve your sense of color, composition, drawing? At Not Sorry Art School, I teach representational painting techniques that'll help you feel more in control of your art and elevate your abilities. With 16 courses from color theories to master studies, painting water, portrait painting, and our latest edition, painting fabric, you'll have everything you need to master representational painting. With access to current and future courses, a supportive community, and personalized feedback, you'll be well on your way to achieving your artistic goals. Lifetime students get full access to all of this, but if you're not ready to commit yet, try our free 7-day boot camp. This is a great way to experience a bite-sized version of what our full course has to offer. To become a lifetime student or check out the 7-day boot camp, make sure to click the link in the show notes. I also wanted to say that today's episode is sponsored by my book. I have a book coming out. I'm so proud of this, guys. The links are already up. I'll have them in the show notes. But the book is called Modern Still Life, From Fruit Bowls to Disco Balls. It is my take on a step-by-step painting book. I am really excited about it. Not only does it have like motivational tips and tricks to keep you going in your practice, but it also has clear and beautiful and full color breakdowns of the step-by-step process in my paintings. So I could not be more excited about it. If you wanted to check it out, order it. It would help me more than you even know. Hey y'all, welcome back to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari. Thanks for being here. Today is my first ever episode of what I'm calling my pocket call-in episodes. And so the idea of this is I've always wanted to do kind of call-in episodes. I just love the format. I really like hearing y'all's voices, and it's designed as like an advice episode. I know I always feel a little out of pocket thinking that I could give advice, but something that I've been really interested in, I don't know, recently in particular, is the idea of sort of like first gen. A lot of times that's used in regards to like college students. Obviously, you can also use it in the context of immigration. That is not how I'm using it, but more in the idea of the first time someone in your family goes to college, you sort of break a seal, so to speak, because you can take some of the more ephemeral bits of information and knowledge that helps someone navigate something like the college school system, and then you can pass that down. It's often advice and insight that lives in the intangibles, the unspoken rules, things like culture. And as someone who is the first person in my family to go to college, I mean, both of my parents didn't even graduate high school. They became pregnant with my brother at a young age. And I have felt like a lot of my career, college running art, has been a lot of me stumbling and falling. And I wish I would have had some insight and some heads up on things. And so whenever I learn things, it feels hard fought. And I have this desire to give back and help other people answer some questions. And they can be really obvious of like, where do you find inspiration? Pretty cut and dry, all the way to like, how do I navigate this aspect of networking? And is there unspoken rules about XYZ? And so I really would like to open myself up as a resource to y'all. And I'm going to kick off this series with a really great question from Gwen, and it is one of those questions that has lots of great nuances. So here is Gwen's question, and then I will answer it to the best of my ability.
Hi, my name is Gwen, and I'm an artist based in Massachusetts. I'm currently a student studying studio art and marketing at Clark University, and I also minor in entrepreneurship. And I have been a big fan ever since I started my art business back in my freshman year of high school. So I'm working towards 7 years of running my business, and you've been a huge inspiration. And I love your podcast. I listen to every episode, and I have a question. And I'm wondering, what are ways in which you can take a serious topic or social issue and render it in both an aesthetic but also impactful visual piece? And how does art actually make a bigger impact and create change in our communities? Currently, I'm working on a project called the Embrace Series, or the Embrace Project, where I'm creating a body of paintings based on a shared need for a sense of love and belonging. And specifically, I'm talking about the topic of homelessness. And you have created so much fun work that's both captivating visually, it's vibrant, it's fun, it has texture, but at the same time, a lot of your work has deeper meanings and deeper statements that make you think a little bit more about the world that we live in. And I think that's amazing. So So if you have any thoughts on that, I would love to hear that in your next episode. Thank you so much and keep up the amazing work.
Thank you, Gwen, so much for asking this question. And I feel absolutely honored that you would think about me in regards to something like this. I want to shout out your project, the series called Embrace. And it sounds amazing and beautiful. And if you've ever would like to share updates with me, I would absolutely love to see this project. So I'm going to start by answering to the best of my ability anyways. I hope it goes without saying that this is just my personal insights, that I am not a be-all, end-all at all. But I'll give you some of the things that I think about in regards to some of the things you mentioned. But your first part of your question is, how does art actually make an impact and create change in our community? And this is a great question. I feel like as artists, a lot of our time and energy is spent sort of advocating for this. Because on one hand, fine art, visual art, whether it's sculpture, painting, is very much a luxury commodity. Just at the end of the day, you're selling a thing for someone to hang on their wall, right? But also, you're creating thought exercises for people to engage with, ways for them to open up their minds, to be more compassionate. If you've read the most recent installment of the Summer Book Club series, Bianca Bosker's Get the Picture, she talks kind of extensively about how when you're selling art, you're kind of selling ideas and concepts. And I would say in that, there is power. As much as I enjoy creating art, and I think it makes me a more thoughtful person, a more compassionate person, a more self-actualized person, I also appreciate art as a viewer. And that's because I think at the end of the day, good art can mean this is deep and important, or it makes me laugh. I mean, there's really quite a range. And the beauty of art is it's just so incredibly subjective. But good art opens me up to a perspective, a thought, an insight, an experience, a sensation that I would never create or steward for myself, either because of the limitations of my existence. You know, I'm a woman, I'm a white woman, I live in Texas, right? All of those things are going to be constraints, but also just that I would never think about something like that. And so, you know, I have a deep love of people in general. I'm rooting for us. I love humans. I think we ultimately can be more good than bad. And I think part of why I'm able to hold on to this value, despite a lot of really heavy things happening in the world, is because I am a constant consumer of people's art, whether I'm purchasing it and collecting it in my own house, or I'm experiencing it on social media. And so how exactly does art change the world? I think anytime you humanize a cause or something or people, you're moving the needle in the right direction. And I'll lead you to a book that I found pretty impactful. I read it recently. It's called Survival of the Friendliest. Just a full warning, it is kind of a heavier book. The first half of the book talks about how we evolved to be friendly. And I usually am super wary of evolution-y based books, but it's really more about the science of the domestication of dogs and wolves. All that to say, I won't ramble too long. You know, our superpower as a human species is that we can deeply relate and share knowledge and information with each other. And our community is and has always been our strength. But the opposite side of that is that the moment we dehumanize someone, the thing that's our strength also opens us up to the most destruction. And that's kind of what the book argues. And so if you can take away something like that from that book, I think that as an artist, our greatest power really shines in that instance. And that is that we introduce new levels of empathy and humanity to each other when we share art, no matter how deep or how light that art might seem. And I can think of so many examples of this. Candy Chang is an artist I really like. She had a series of projects called Before I Die, where she turned walls of buildings into spaces where people could write what they wanted to achieve with their lives. And I remember learning about her in college, specifically after she did a series in New Orleans in the wake of Katrina. And it was to write on these buildings, "I wish this was," where people in the community who maybe wouldn't have thought of themselves as art people, I mean, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, it's kind of irrelevant, because all the people in the community were able to write in what they hoped for this building and this vacant spot. And I think, you know, and again, you can think of so many different kinds of art, you know, to fill in the blank here. But when you think of a piece of art creating a better world. I mean, there's so many examples. I really just pulled kind of one that was most top of mind out of a hat, so to speak. But if that isn't eliciting change for the better, of getting people to be hopeful and to put their minds towards a future that they would want, you're inviting people to creatively collaborate with you. You're creating a sense of community. And, you know, getting to kind of the other part of your question of like, how do you have people think of bigger, deeper societal things while not having to relegate yourself to big, heavy, daunting art? This is a great question and something that I'm always sort of actively sparring with. I'll start by kind of walking you through my personal journey to sort of my style and subject matter. And I'm hoping that through my anecdotal story, that maybe I can sort of glean how I'm dealing with that theme in my own artwork. So, you know, I was always an artsy kid, artsy by nature of, I loved color, I loved putting together an outfit, I was a constant doodler, I really think in visuals, but I really didn't consider myself a painter until college when I began painting. And I started out just wanting to document the neighborhoods I grew up in. So a funny story, I guess funny maybe isn't the right word, but a very important story in my lore and who I am, is I was an art student, but I was also on the cross country team. That's how I was able to pay for my college. I did cross country and track. And so this was a group of girls who grew up somewhere between middle and upper class who were running on these running scholarships. It was a great group of girls. This is not a knock against them by any stretch of the imagination. But where our college was located was really only about 2 miles south of where I grew up. In my apartment complex, which were government subsidized, we lived in a HUD house for a little bit. And the girls on the team were from Kansas City and St. Louis suburbs. A couple of girls were from the south side of my city, which was the nicer, newer part. And I was from the north side, which was the older, you know, dilapidated half of the city. And every time we would go on a run, the girls would always insist that we go south. And it was sort of an unspoken thing. And it wasn't until I was on the team that I was like, hey, we're really close to my old running grounds. If you just run a little bit north, the streets open up, they become less busy, there's hills, it's all beautiful country and farmland. But yeah, you have to run through about, you know, 2.5 miles of, you know, older neighborhoods. And I remember this was kind of a point of contention because I would encourage them to run north and everyone would say, no, my parents told me not to run in that direction. It's unsafe. There are homeless people. It's scary. It's yucky. It's ugly. I don't want to. And I remember being kind of an indignant, you know, 19-year-old, whatever. And I would look up local crime and I would say, hey, when you head actually towards like south, like city center, there's significantly more crime than up north where I'm from. Like just because people are poor doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to hurt you. They're just like smoking cigarettes on their porch, you know, and I tried to argue it that way. And I think what ended up happening is it became a bit of a proxy for the class struggles that I was feeling as like a first generation college student in this, you know, sport. It was a school that was already sort of private liberal arts, $30,000 a year to go there unless you had a scholarship of some sort. And then also distance running tends to, not always, but be a sport that people who are maybe more middle class enjoy. Obviously not entirely. I was there, you know, but there was such a huge culture clash. And this was one of the ways it played out. Cut to back in my art classes. And I don't even think this was so top of mind, but I found myself being like, these old houses are beautiful. It looks like what I grew up with. Like something about seeing a porch where like just moments before someone could have been on their back porch smoking a cigarette and talking about the future just felt so like important and human to me. And I don't think what my teammates thought they were doing was hurting me. You know, these were girls that are, I'm still friends with some of them. And I think to their credit, they were also 18, 19, 20-year-old girls whose parents were like, hey, be careful, be safe. But something about the assumption that everything you grew up with and you love is like dangerous and scary and bad and repulsive leaves you in a place where you're sort of fighting for your humanity in a way that I don't think I was aware of at the time. Gosh, you know, I'm retelling this story and I'm finding myself feeling like really randomly emotional. And the funny thing about it is at the time, my painting professor was encouraging us to to write artist statements about what we were making art about. And I can remember being like, I have no clue why I want to paint these houses. I just do. And now, 10 years later, a lot of therapy under my belt, a lot of insight, a lot of reading about class dynamics, and a lot of artist statements later, I can definitely tell that there was something deeper happening. But all I know is at the time, painting these neighborhoods that were so repulsive to my teammates to the point where it was like causing conflict, I needed to see those places painted with dignity and love. You know, I have this belief that anything in the right light can be beautiful. And seeing that, seeing myself put what I knew was like this real shot at social mobility and a kindness that I deserve and that all humans deserve via a college education and the classes and discipline it took to be able to get those painting skills down and an understanding of color theory was going into these houses in a way that I felt like that needed dignity and love and respect. And to me, that's always kind of been what painting is. It's a moment where the labor of love, the intentionality, the fact that painting has historically and contextually always been something that's elevated, right? You know, and I agree that it doesn't need to be more elevated than craft, you know, that crocheting and knitting and, you know, acrylic nails and all of these other forms of artwork that tend to get sorted through a hierarchy in a way that I don't think is fair. But I've always had a certain pragmatism to me where it's like, yes, that's not fair. But also, like, can I lean into the fact that if something is painted in oil on a canvas, it's elevated? And can I take the things in my life that I've always felt like something I needed to fight for? Can I put them on a canvas? And does that do something to me? Does that make me respond? Does it make other people respond to this? And it did. And it does. And so I started with these landscapes. And as I've moved through my career, I would say that that idea that painting something with love, thought, intentionality has always been maybe my main lens at which I look and create artwork. And what ends up happening with that is that it doesn't mean that I'm always painting things that are to look somber and to look dark and to convey the levity and seriousness of something. And I think that might be, if I'm understanding your question, the heart of what you're asking, which is, can you play? Can you be light? Can you be sweet and soft and silly and still elicit change in the world and still convey the seriousness and importance of really important topics? Like, you know, for me, it's a lot of gender and class type issues. And I think the answer is absolutely yes. You know, and I have looked at my own painting and I've noticed sort of, because the best gift you can give yourself as an artist is the ability to look at your artwork in a way that's detached from yourself a little bit. Like, obviously when you're making your art, you're going to have your own DNA in there. It's just, it's like the nature of making artwork. But if you can give yourself the space to be like, why do you have to make everything polished and colorful? Like, what is it about you? And I think an insight that I've gained in my career is that I have a compulsion to make things beautiful, pretty, polished, vector-like is a word that comes up a lot, because to make things pretty and polished and perfect looking has been a survival tool of mine. You know, poor and girl is a hard combo. And obviously, the more intersections you bear there, the harder, of course. And my whiteness has always been a massive privilege. But when I think of what the uniqueness at the intersection of poor and woman is, it's this need to appear better than your situation. And a really compulsive need to make sure you look polished. You know, I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but growing up, you know, if one of us kids were sick or my mom was sick and she needed to go to the hospital, she would have to get us as cleaned up, as dressed up, as nice looking as possible, our nicest, newest clothes, or else there was a real fear of being like a drug seeker, you know? And so I think that was sort of a subconscious for me, and it showed up in my artwork. And I had people sort of say, like, you know, your artwork isn't as good because art has moved past the need for polish and beauty. And I think I've stuck kind of a stake in the sand and said, like, sure, but it, for me, it's an extension of how I've coped with this chaotic world. And so it does create a world where when I submit my stuff, and I've seen this in real life, especially with men who don't get it, who don't, you know, that they see polish and pretty and maybe don't always understand what's going on. There is this idea that sometimes my stuff may not be taken as seriously. But I've always been really clear that, like, at the end of the day, I'm making art for people who get my art and who it helps. And so I think the way I deal with this is I'm always turning over stones with my artwork. the pretty, the fun, the polished, the silly. And I'm asking myself, does this help or does this hinder what I'm trying to say? And despite the fact that culturally there's this real big push for things to be serious in order to make change or to be dark in order to elicit the right emotions from people, I find that my need for joy and silly and compulsive beautification are all parts of my creative DNA. Like, it to me, I guess I can say it like this. If I had to develop the tools to make everything polished and pretty as a survival tool, and now I'm in a different career and I need to make everything somber and serious to be taken seriously, I just sort of am choosing how I want to deal with that in a way that honors, I think, who I am as an artist. And if it knocks me out of contention, which I know it has, for being taken seriously, then I will make up for that by adding the appropriate context for my art to be understood. There's a saying often where it's like your art should be able to speak on its own. And I think that's a wonderful lens to have for your art, right? Like, how does it speak to people without any context? And I have found that, specifically if you're listening to this and you are someone who's deviates from like the hegemony, like the, like, you know, white Anglo man focused kind of, the more you sort of deviate from that, the more you have to really contort yourself to make sure that you're understood by that audience. And that contortion might change your art to a place where it no longer is recognizable to you. And I would always warn against it. And obviously we all have to approach that with our own sense of pragmatism that I would never project onto anyone. I think that's as an artist, you're always having to make that call for yourself. But I would always push back against the idea that you shouldn't have to speak for your art, or your art should speak for itself. That's true if your art is in like a Chelsea gallery with white walls and some name in it, and people can walk into it and say, I'm experiencing artwork and I'm going to look deeper and I'm going to look past, you know, do what we do with art that someone has said is really good. We take time with it. We spend moments with it. We read the name cards. We, you know, say that this is important. Therefore, I'm going to hold my attention to it. I'm not going to crumble into tropes and ideas that are very simple. I'm going to push past it, right? That's what artwork being in that sort of context or setting does for us. Now, those of us who are showing our art on social media, because that's what we have access to, who are showing our arts in smaller galleries or even just to friends and family, which all of those are totally valid, we often have to fight against a context that works against us, right? I know, I am self-aware enough to know that when I share artwork, it's probably sandwiched between, you know, an ad and someone else's art and maybe a paid partnership. Like, that's just where I'm shown. And so because of that, I've always leaned into the fact that I may have to add a layer of context, which could be a voiceover, which could be a caption, which could be, you know, pulling out other artists who I look up to create sort of a world for my art to live in. Okay, that's a lot of Sari nuance and rambling. And I always challenge myself to try to walk away from any advice with like tangible things that an artist might be able to hold and make use of. And so the first thing I would offer up, if as an artist, you find yourself wanting to make artwork that is impactful and that does something while balancing joy and lightness, and I would say first, completely dismiss the trope, the false trope, in my personal opinion, that in order for something to be meaningful, it has to be dark and heavy and painful. That's not true. It can be. And I think those tools are just that. They're tools in an artist's toolkit. I do think that there's value in the trope of art comforts the uncomfortable and adds discomfort to the comfortable, right? I think that that can be powerful. And I think if you do use discomfort to get people to empathize with what you're doing, that that can be powerful. And I'm never saying that you shouldn't do that. But if you find yourself making art and the way that that shows up, whether you're processing trauma, whether you're trying to shine light on something hard, is through things that often have visual overlap with joy, don't feel bullied out of it. Like, sometimes being someone who has lived through struggle or is experiencing something hard, joy is like the most rebellious and radical thing you can do, especially if you live in an identity that is often, your pain is somehow commodified. I would encourage you to A, protect yourself or whatever that looks like, right? But then B, like, you don't have, not everything you do has to be a learning lesson for somebody else. Like, your art is, yes, something you share with the world, but it, at, in the beginning, it's yours. Like, at the most important It is something that belongs to you. And if joy is how you process that, then joy is what people are going to get, you know? And that's okay. I think it's important to also, on the other side, be mindful, particularly if you are making art, about something that you personally haven't experienced yourself. And I'm not saying you can't do that. I think a lot of people are great advocates in their artwork, but just to be careful with certain themes of humor and stuff. And I will say, because I make art that's so personal to me, we're veering into a territory where I feel like I have less expertise. I do think you can be an artist who is an advocate, and I think that that work is incredibly important. I think the trick there is always to maintain constant conversation with those that you're serving and making sure that the tone, the feeling honors those who have experienced that firsthand and personally. The other thing that I would recommend as a tangible thing to walk away with is having a constant practice of an artist statement. Some people, I think, assume an artist statement is this fixed, static thing, that it's like a stamp on your art and it's going to trap you into a certain ideology, when I prefer to think of it as like a living journal, and that you're always kind of writing it and you're always kind of tweaking it and you're always kind of changing it. And you might say stuff that you grow into, and you might say stuff that you quickly grow out of, like a little, you know, hermit crab shell, you know, and that's okay. Like, you make art because words aren't adequate sometimes, right? It overflows what you could say, and that's why you make visual art. And so, but I think having an artist statement all the while is a great tool for creating the context that helps inform your artwork. In fact, so many of the times I do voiceovers, I'm pulling thoughts and ideas and themes that I've worked through in my artist statement, whether it's an idea of something that I think I might include in my artist statement, something that is currently an important aspect of my artist statement. Having that writing practice, even if it's like you're not a writer and, you know, you don't think your writing is the greatest in the world, that's okay. Having a writing practice can be very, very helpful in learning how to create the proper context. And then finally, how are people who are doing it well doing it? Is there context because they are in the right environments? And, you know, it's no shade to anyone who has access to those great Chelsea galleries and all of that wonderful context that comes with it. But is someone being taken seriously because of that access? And how does that inform their work? And then if you don't have access, how can you create that context for yourself in your artwork? Is it artist statements? Is it saying that you're part of a movement? Is it going ahead and being really intentional with what you're trying to do? Understand that that doesn't make your work simple. You know, you can say your art means something and there could be 10 other layers underneath it, and that's totally fine. But I would say, you know, there's a real fear of writing down what you're doing in a way that traps you. And I would say that I have only ever found writing and creating written and verbal context to be incredibly helpful, I think, for my artwork. And of course, this does mean that people get it wrong sometimes, but that's okay. You know, I think the metric for me of whether artwork is working correctly or not is if, to pull a common internet trope out of a hat here, the girls who get it is something I kind of live by. And I get DMs from people, enough of an increment that it's deeply encouraging, who say, I grew up like you, your work makes me feel seen. And I think for me, getting that kind of feedback is always a clue that I'm on the right path. And it doesn't mean I always get it perfect. Art is a practice after all. But for me, the fact that a male juror tells me that my work is silly and redundant and, you know, whatever, I don't care. Because I hear people who have lived experiences closer to me who get it. And I think that for me is like my gold star stamp of approval that exists outside of me. And of course, my main metric is, does this make me feel good and feel honored? And, you know, art is a dance. You're not just making journal entries on canvas, you're sharing it with the world. And I think you never get it perfectly 100% right. But I think if I can honor those two things, then I'm on the right path. I wanted to say a huge thank you again, Gwen, for leaving such a wonderful and layered question. I really appreciate it. I wish you all of the luck. I hope that this answer somewhat gets to what you were hoping for. It's definitely my best attempt. And I think this is something I wish I would have heard earlier in my career. I think it would have been a little bit reassuring, hopefully. If you would like to have your question featured on another Pocket episode, and again, it doesn't have to be as gorgeous and layered of a question as this episode. It can be just simply like, what do you use to gesso? Feel free to reach out to the number below. I always love hearing y'all's voices. It feels so personal and amazing, and I just really value it. And I will feature your question on another episode that hopefully I'm going to sprinkle throughout the rest of the year as I take a little bit of time off. I also have a couple of last interviews that I'm getting in before the end of the year, so it's less of a harsh August cutoff for y'all. There's a few more episodes, but I really enjoy these pocket episodes. So if you wanted to leave that, I'll get back to your question to the best of my abilities. Have a great rest of your week. Happy creating, and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for being here. I wanted to also encourage you guys to leave a review. The feedback is incredibly helpful, and if you leave a review, I will read your handle or your name on the following week's episode. Again, thank you so much. Take care, y'all, and happy creating.